morning and welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001. Nation, His kingdom, His people, and your radio station.
Shalom to all of you, and welcome to Wisdom and Torah Ministries. Right now, I'm filling in a little bit of a time for some of the brothers of Hebrew Nation Radio. Please, I'm sorry, it's early over here for me. And I'm delighted to have the opportunity to share with you some of the stuff that we have in store for you today. With me today, I have my friend, my teacher, and a mentor. His name is Joseph Good. Joseph Good, please say hello to everybody.
Hello, shalom, shalom.
Thank you, Joe, for being with us. And, you know, one of the things that I want to say about you, and I don't mean to embarrass you in any way, but I really appreciate your wisdom, your understanding, your humility, and your willingness to help and teach us and help us understand so many things that have been removed from us for the last 2,000 years. And truly, the research that you've done clearly helps us understand a very, very difficult topic that it just so happened that to come in the forefront lately among so many of the topics that are bringing confusion to the body or trying to distract the body. One of the topics here, Joe, is temple location. But before we get into it, I wanna let you say a few words to the audience and say hello.
Well, first, Rico, I want to thank you for inviting me to be with you. It's been a real pleasure the last several years studying the temple with you. And you and I and two others just returned from Jerusalem, where we went over to go to these sites specifically. Everything was centered on the temple. We went to sites, we came back, we looked at the scripture, we studied, we looked at all types of documents and everything. And you know, it tells the story. And it's just a pleasure to be able to have the opportunity and the platform to be able to share the story of the temple, where it was located, and what it's about with everyone.
Amen. I'll tell you one thing. If you guys want to go to Israel and learn about the temple, come with us one time and let Joe walk you ragged through the city of Jerusalem. This man can walk. Oh, my Lord. He made this young man, and compared to him, be like an older man compared to him. Oh, boy, he can walk. He was actually playing with me, too. He was telling me how out of shape I was. And I thought I was in shape. But it was a really cool experience, Joe, because we had an opportunity. Remember the first time, let's try to give them a little insight before we get into the topic. Let's take a few minutes and what we did, because it was very unique. I called you. We were studying when I came back from Israel in November. We were talking about the trip to Israel because you took a trip to Israel in November.
Right.
I think we missed each other by one week.
Time. Well, we were there at the same time, but we missed the country.
Right. So when you were in Jerusalem, I was in the Galilee. And then when you were home, I was in Jerusalem. I remember I came back in December. We sat down to study because many people don't know, but we study together almost every week. Actually, I study with you because you get to teach me. So we study almost every week. You spend countless hours trying to help me understand better and to share information. And I remember you asked me the question, hey, how was Jerusalem? I said, well, it was great. And he goes, well, did you go here? I say, well, yeah. And then Joe goes on to tells me, no, but did you see this? And I say, no. And I begin to write it down. And after 16 places that I've been to Jerusalem now since 2004, 16 times, all right? And Joe mentioned to me places that I have never been to in the old city. And I feel ashamed. So what was the course of action we took, Joe? Let's go to Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's right. Before we got off the phone, you purchased tickets.
Yeah, I was like, wait a second. I did not see Jerusalem. Hey, I called my son, Tito, find out how much the tickets are. You know, I'm blessed that I was able to save a little money for a special occasion. And this was the occasion to go learn in Jerusalem, invested in my growth and invested in my development. And I got to tell you, Joe, would you agree that 10 hours a day is not enough?
Oh, easily. I mean, we spent ever been at 10 hours. I'm going to guess on most days we spent more than 10 hours between going out to the sites and coming back. And we'd often work till midnight at night because
much,
we just
didn't
want to stop. I mean, it was exciting.
I remember one of the PowerPoints you were showing us that it was it's kind of a personal encounter that I had when I got it. I mean, when I got it, when I understood the dimension of the wealth of information and how it ties in with the Bible. And at that moment, I felt humbled and I felt overwhelmed. And while everybody's arguing, so my question to you, Joe, is this. How can people argue about things they don't quite understand? That's my question.
Yeah, I don't have the answer to it.
I mean, you've been doing this for what, 40 years now? You've been studying solely. You've been one of the people that I know that many people don't know the level of understanding you have in a whole bunch of other areas in the Bible. But you are known for your love for the temple. And I want to share with you a story, a conversation that I'm having with Joe in Jerusalem or in the room. I don't remember where it was now, but this is really what got me to appreciate you a little more, brother, is that understanding the levels of holiness in the temple and the perimeters, the soveg, and where you can go and cannot go in the temple. And I asked you, and your level of respect for the holy areas of the temple, even to this day. I asked you, I said, how does it feel? And it dawned on me when I was thinking about this, and I'm thinking, how does it feel, Joe, to study this for so many years, to teach people about the holiness of the temple, the perimeters of the temple, the thresholds and where you can, cannot go, the functions of the temple, the measurements, the location of the temple, but yet in the millennial reign, when the temple is rededicated, you know, there are certain areas you cannot go into, because if you're not a Kohen, you're not going to be able to go in there. And I love the answer you gave me. You said, it's okay with me. And that said a lot about the type of heart that we need in order to understand the temple. We can make it about us. We cannot be more important than the message. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree with that.
So the inspiration to study the temple comes from the desire to know the house of the Lord. We know that the temple is not only a house, but it's become a home when the spirit of the living Elohim dwells in it. Right now, the spirit of Elohim is not literally on the mountain, but we know that's a place where he has put his name. So, Joe, what I would like to do for the next 2 hours is divide the time. In the first hour, let's talk about location of the temple. No, I'm sorry, the location of the temple, but from the above. The buildings.
Above ground.
Above ground. The second hour, we're going to try to, it's kind of hard because we don't have the pictures to go with it. But if you've been following my Facebook, I've been placing all kinds of topographical maps. And the second hour, we're going to try to deal with the cisterns, the water supply, because the whole premise of the moving of the location from the Temple Mount to the city of David is the Gihon Spring. So we will answer those questions today. So let's say, Joe, you and I, we open our Bibles and let's take those verses that people utilize to say that the temple cannot be on the Temple Mount, which is this. First verse is Matthew 24. And I want us to pay attention to the context of what the disciples and Yeshua is talking about. Matthew 24, verse 1 and 2 says this. Then Yeshua went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. Okay, he's not talking about the city right now. He's talking about the temple proper, the temple structure, the 35 acres and the buildings that are in on top of that mountain. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes, totally. I mean, if we take it literally, to show him the buildings of the temple. So that is going to be the temple building itself. The buildings that are going to be around your inner courtyards. There's two inner courtyards, and then you have several structures that are going to be located on the Temple Mount. So they're obviously talking about those structures.
Right. So let's go back. What I'm going to do, I'm going to read all the verses that are referenced to this verse, and then we're going to make the distinction. So let's go to Mark chapters 13, verse 1 and 2. Mark 13, verse 1 and 2 says this. Then he said that he went out of the temple. Again, this is a specific location. One of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here?" And Yeshua said to him, "Do you see these great buildings?" Now, but 90% of the people, Joe, have no idea of the size and the scope of the buildings. They focus on the wall, the retaining walls, but not the buildings. We're going to go there in a minute. So let me finish this, and then we get into it. Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. So he's talking about the temple buildings. Okay, right. So let's go to Luke chapters 21. Luke chapters 21. So right now we read three verses, which is talking about the temple buildings, not the city itself. Three witnesses. Okay, Luke 21, 5 and 6. Then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, "As for these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." So he's talking about the temple. Three verses. He's talking about the temple. So let me put out the question to all the audience that is listening, all the people who agree and disagree with me. And by the way, you don't have to agree with us. Just verify the information. And if you're really honest with the research, Joe, would you agree with me that if you're really honest with the research, it's only going to take you not an hour to really verify this stuff?
Oh, easy. The evidence is overwhelming.
The problem is this. And the question to the audience and my brothers and sisters that are watching, do you know, and I'm going to be very strong on this particular question, because these teachings are getting a hold of the whole movement, and again, we are committing encroachment. And normally, I don't focus on what other people are teaching. I just do my thing. But when it comes to the temple of the Lord, we are commanded not to change one little thing. You don't play around with a pattern. The Tavnit, and this just so happened that this week's Torah portion deals with the Tavnit, the pattern of the tabernacle. We will also talk about that. So, Joe, let's get right into the audience. Do you know the name of the buildings and its function that Yeshua clearly is referring to? So, Joe, let's start with the outer court and the court of the Gentiles, which would answer also the water issues and needs there. Go ahead, brother.
Okay, in your outer court, first off, the people enter from the south. We're told that in numbers of different texts that the entry was from the south for the population. Okay, there are two tunnels there. These tunnels have gates in front of them. Now, the tunnels were adorned on the inside magnificently. They have domes in the top of them with all kinds of geometric patterns, and it's just unbelievable. I had the opportunity to go down into these tunnels several years ago, several times. And these are the gates that Yeshua refers to as the beautiful gates. Now, they're going
Hulda,
to be...
Hulda, right? They're Hulda, that's right.
Right. We call them the Hulda gates, and it comes from a word that means to come up from the ground from underneath. So they're tunnels that lead you up into the outer courtyard. Now, above this, on the surface, there is a huge portico. Portico is going to be a colonnaded, a covered area, and it's called the Royal Stoa. It will stand several stories high, gigantic structure. The eastern one-third of this, and it's going to be across the entire southern wall, is going to be the second quarters of the Sanhedrin, where the next two-thirds to the west are going to be the marketplace, the bazaar.
Okay, so to give a people an idea of the geography of the temple here, we're talking about the southern part of the temple wall, where you see the monumental steps going up and the Hulda gate. Okay, so for the people who are now, you know, like just to so people would get a picture of this, though that stoa was built there by Herod. It was not there for the first temple or second temple period. Correct?
That's right.
Okay, this is very important. This is very important to cover. That's right.
In fact, that area was had to be built up by Herod in order to place this stoa on it, because before that time, the ground, the elevation just dropped away, and he built platforms.
Well, by the way, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that in a minute, because now this is one of the things that when you and I were in Israel that really made a really difference for me is understanding the topography of the land. Like, yes. For example, the Kidron Valley and the Theropian Valley, the Cheesemaker Valley, which is it hugs the whole Western Wall all the way up to Fort Antonia, all the way down to the Shiloah, the Pool of Siloe. Siloah, right? That was a cleft. That was a that was down. That went down farther than what it is now. And you were showing me that it was the Muslim period in which they peeled that up on the western side of the of that area.
That's right. That's right. During the Muslim period, this has all been documented. All the houses that you see in the Muslim quarter and everything, they were built on top. They filled in rubble. They built on top in order to make the level of the city the same height as the Temple Mount.
So do you think then the problem is that modern day people, when you go to Jerusalem, you see everything so built up, and it doesn't dawn on you that that was a valley of, actually, there was a perfect protection against armies because they couldn't really climb it up. They had walls there too at one point in the city of David. So what you see today is not even close to what was there at the time of Solomon, David, the first century either. You know, I mean, it was built up in different ways than it is today.
Right. Rico, you brought up something very important. You could go there to Jerusalem, and unless somebody points this out to you, you could go back home and never have an idea about it. You did it 16 times.
Tell me about it. I mean, I was blown away when we took that tunnel coming down from the Shiloah all the way up to the southern western part of the temple. That we came up from the ground, that we saw the foundations of the temple. But that's for the second hour. We're going to go underground. So right now we're focusing on the southern part of the temple, and there were mikvaot, there were baptism, and there were bathrooms in that area.
Well, one more thing we need to say on the southern wall. Uh-huh. At the southwestern corner, at the very corner, there was a place where a priest would go to blow a silver trumpet to announce the coming of the Sabbath, to announce the end of the Sabbath. He would blow at the new moon. He would blow at the festival days. And it had an inscription that was there called the House of the Trumpeting to separate between the holy and the common. And so that's all going to be on your southern wall.
Right.
Then as you come out of the tunnels, there's going to be three buildings. The first building will be a mikvah. That will be to your left-hand side. It's going to be a little bit larger building than the second one. And that's going to be a mikvah or an immersion chamber. There will be another building that is to your right-hand side, a little bit smaller, another mikvah. And then to the right of that, there will be a very long building. Now, when I say a long building, I'm going to say probably almost 50 or 60 yards in length, which will be two sets of toilets. In other words, there'll be a smaller section of toilets, and then there'll be a larger section of toilets.
Yeah, but when you read the Mishnah and some of the rabbinical books and the evidence about toilets, you never see it, because the name that it uses for that is what? This is really good. Check it out.
Okay. First off, the toilets are called a throne of dignity, and secondly, they're going to be always in conjunction on the Temple Mount with the Beit Tevilah, the house of immersion. And so you have these two mikvaot and then the toilets.
Now, you know what's interesting? In the second hour, we're going to go back over the structures, and then we're going to point out that exactly where these buildings were, we can now have the topographical underground, all that stuff searched out by Warren and Sheik and some of the other archaeologists, and you know, and they have cisterns underneath those places which would verify the locations of these buildings. So we will cover that in the next hour. Okay, so now we're moving now towards the court of the women. There are four chambers in the court of the women. Let's talk a little bit about the function of those four chambers and more or less of the sizes of those four chambers.
Okay. All right. We're going to have building-wise, we're going to have the court of the women. It's going to be 135 cubits by 135 cubits in its in a square shape.
Now, that's roughly around how many feet? I mean, I'm terrible with the measurements. I got to learn that. So let's give them a reference, Joe. I'm sorry I keep interrupting you, but if they don't get a reference in the language they understand it, then they're going to say, oh, man, Rico and Joe, they're speaking in tongues over there. No one understands them.
All right. So that's going to be give me a second here that I can do a calculation.
And as you say that, those four buildings have a function, and as you figure that out, let me know. We have the Lishkat Nazir, which is the room for the Nazarite. We have the Lishkat Mezorim, which is for the lepers in the northwest corner of the court of the women. Then we have the room for the wood on the northeastern corner, and we have the oils on the southwestern corner. So each room had a purpose and a function.
Right.
Do you have the feet measurements?
Right. It's 216 feet, which on each side, which comes out to 72 yards. Okay, that's 3/4 of a football field. 72 yards by 72 yards by 72 yards by 72 yards. That is your square called the court of the women. Now, on the sides, you have these four chambers. They're each 40 cubits by 40 cubits.
And, that's like 64 feet.
Okay. 64 feet for each wall, each side of these four chambers. Now,
that's pretty big size, Joe.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good size. That's a big building. And one of the chambers, we're told, had a mikvah underneath it because it's the chamber of the lepers on your northwestern corner.
Right, and so, that is cistern number 27.
Right, right. So, again, we have verification of where these buildings were located. Then we have 15 steps that take us up into the from the court of the women to the court of the inner courtyard called the Azarah. Now, each of the steps is half a cubit by half a cubit. So it's about 9 1/4 inches, I believe, for each step.
Now, Joe, allow me to interrupt you real quickly, because this is the little detail that really transformed my mindset around the temple. And you know it because you were there. So when we realized that the steps leading from the court of the women to the Azarah, where the high location, where the high level of holiness was, where the priests were, compared to the steps in the inner courtyard, the steps in the inner courtyard's measurements were different than the ones in the court of the women. One was 9.2 inches, I think, right? And the other one was 11 inches in the steps. That's what really got my attention to all of us. They'll go, why in the world do we need to know this? Because it shows us that even in the temple, even in the measurements of the steps, it shows us how to go up to a higher level of holiness. That not everything's the same, that you're going into a higher level of status. And that really, really resonated with me. That even in the measurements, there's nothing by coincidence, right?
Right. Now, let me give you a measurement here, because we're going to have a rise in the elevation from the court of the women to the Azarah, to your
Remember,
your
we got a few more seconds. We're going to interrupt you. I'm sorry about this, but when it cuts off, then we're going to come back, so don't go too far. We got like 20 seconds before we go, Joe. Hold your thought real quickly before you go on the next, on the more information on that. So right now we've covered the outer court. We're going into the inner court area, and please come back with us for more information on the temple location with Rico Cortez and Joseph Good.
We will lift you up.
Listening to Hebrew Nation Radio, a division of Torah to the nations.
We are
Guys, welcome back to the next half hour of our program on Temple Location. My name is Rico Cortez. Holy is your name. Amen. We are so delighted to have the opportunity to share with you a little bit on the location of the temple, the buildings of the temple, the size of the buildings of the temple. And I want to thank Joe Good for being here with me today and for sharing such an important topic. So, Joe, as we were talking in the last half hour, we were speaking about some of the locations in which we were entering from the south. We saw the mikvaot, the immersion pools, which, by the way, in the second hour, we're going to cover the cisterns, the water supply that is under those places. And now we are heading towards the court of the women. When we went into the court of the women, we spoke about the size of the buildings in the court of the women, which is the court itself is how many yards again? The court of the women square?
135 by 135 cubits.
135 cubits by 135, which in yards would be like 76, somewhere around there?
72, I believe.
72 yards. That's quite a big area for the court of the women. Now, each building, according to the measurements that you helped me take in regards to my teaching on the Nazarite vow, it was like 64 by 64 by 32. 32 high. Feet high, 64 feet wide in depth, and so the buildings were quite big. And this is something that 90% of the people that study the New Testament have no idea of the magnitude of the size of the buildings, Joe.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are humongous. That, you know, mentioning that, I know that you've studied a lot about Rome and the Roman Empire. One of the greatest builders of the Roman Empire was Agrippa, who was like second in command to Caesar Augustus. Now, he came to Jerusalem, and he was overwhelmed by the grandeur and the size of these buildings.
Well, it was one of the wonders of the world back in the day. Even the rabbis would say, if you've never seen the temple, you've never seen such a beautiful thing. So we're dealing with the sizes of the buildings. Now, we're going to go from the court of the women, and we're going to go up 12 feet in elevation. This is one of the things, Joe, that we need to make mention of, that when you look at Conrad Sheik's model, and when you look at Warren's maps, topographical map, many people never consider the elevation and the high point of the whole mountain. And this is the reason why people now move it to the city of David, which is a lower ground. So from the court of the women, the 15 steps, which is 9.6 inches each step, going up to the Azara, the court of Israel, and then the court of the priests, we have how many feet again? 12 feet?
12 feet.
In elevation. So you will be standing at the bottom of the court of the women, and you really couldn't see some of the buildings. And by the way, the temple structure was like 22 stories high. It's 100 cubits by 100 cubits. It's very big. So go ahead and tell us a little bit more about the transition from the court of it, from the women to the court of Israel and the court of the priests.
Right. Now, one of the most amazing parts we'll talk about in the second segment of this is that elevation rise, that should still be there. You should still be able to see that 12 foot if you know where to look.
Yeah, I saw it, by the way. I took pictures of it.
It's going to be a massive platform.
Right.
And we're going to have, first off, the size of the inner courtyard, the Azara, is going to be 187 cubits by 135 cubits. Okay, now we're going to have a cubit change at this point.
Wait a minute. Let's explain to them, define the terms. The Azara is all of the area where the priests were allowed to walk, which is a high level of holiness. It included, for the sake of the audience, it included huge buildings to the north and to the south of the of that particular courtyard, correct?
Right.
All right, so it's not just the area where the priests will do the service on the altar, but we are including Beit Aptinas in the southeast, Beit Otzrot in the southwest, Beit HaMoked in the northwest, and Beit HaNitzot in the northeast, right?
Right.
Now, I got a question for you. So how and why would people quote the verses, establish a theology all solely on words that Yeshua said on the buildings of the temple, and yet would never take the time to know the buildings, their measurements, their height, the locations, and everything therein? Do you think that's a fair argument to argue and to change the location of the temple without really looking honestly and seriously into all of this evidence?
By all means, you have to look at the evidence. It's going the size of the buildings is just astronomical. You know, around the inner courtyard, you have five huge buildings. Now, that's not including the temple building. Temple building is going to be the biggest of all. But these buildings are going to be 8 stories high. They're 192 feet by 64 feet wide. That's 96 yards. And it's lengthwise going from the south to the north, and it's going to be 32 yards wide.
Wait. Repeat that again. We need to get the people to understand the magnitude of the buildings that Yeshua was beholding when he says those words. Okay, you said it's 8 stories high, it's 50 cubits, which in turn is 192 feet high.
No, that's 100 cubits. That's 100 cubits.
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
That's 192 feet in length.
In length, gotcha. Long.
Long, which comes out to 96 yards.
That's crazy.
Okay. Then its width is going to be 64 feet, that will come out to 20-something yards. I think I gave you a wrong measurement here. Let me do...
Yeah, it's 60. I think it's 64 feet, because that's the same. It's crazy how big these things were. So when Yeshua is looking at those buildings, so the question is, are any of those buildings still standing? No.
No.
They were destroyed just like Yeshua said.
Not what stone is left. However, some of these buildings had very, very heavy water usage.
Right.
In particular, the one on the south. Eastern quarter.
Don't give it away. We're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Right, but that's where the water for the whole Azarah was regulated from. So we want to remember that.
Okay.
Underneath that building, we have a heavy, heavy water supply. Also, the one that we have on the northeastern quarter, it has a heavy water supply.
And by the way, the cisterns that have been discovered by archaeologists and underground facilitators is cistern number 28 and also cistern number 29 and 30. So we do have the underground evidence that whatever was placed above it, underneath of it, was a huge amount of water that was gathered for the service. So we're going to cover that on the second hour, but right now we're trying to give a rundown of the buildings. By the way, before you continue, Joe, I want to recommend everybody to Joe's Good. It's called Measure the Pattern, Volume 1. He goes into very great detail, utilizing all of the information available on the temple, not only topographical maps, archaeology, history, Josephus, the Mishnah, anything available. And he's done something very unique that he's put it all together, not to only talk about the sizes of the building and its functions, but also the location and how we can prove it through archaeology. Amazing work, Joe, that you did. I want to thank you for putting all that together. So let's continue on the building. So right now we are in the side buildings of the 187 cubits of the whole temple area where the building was. And we're talking about the sizes.
Right. So we have, as we mentioned, these corner buildings. We have the Beit Aftidus, or the House of Aftidus. Aftidus was a family that made, a priestly family that compounded incense. So the building was called by that name. That was its primary name, but there were numbers and numbers of names because there were a lot of offices, chambers. There was actually a gate that went through this building. It was a major administrative center. And so the Sanhedrin met inside that building. And so they had their court chambers inside there.
By the way, this is really important to know because there are two Mishnah. There's the Archscroll Mishnah and there's the Kehati. And the Kehati is really the authority according to how the rabbis, when they study the Mishnah, they rather use the Kehati. And there's a mistake in the arch crow, in which it places Beit Lishkan Hagasit, the Sanhedrin Council meeting, on the north end of the Azara, which is in a different building altogether. And you found, based on the topography and the cisterns and the location and even the Mishnah, that is actually in Beit Aftina in the southern part where the water gate was.
Right.
Gotcha.
Right.
Keep going.
Okay, so we're going to have another building that is going to be on the southwestern corner. Now, this building, same size, it's 100 cubits long by 50 cubits wide. It's going to be 40 cubits high, another 8-story building, exactly, precisely the same size. Now, that building was there in the first temple. In fact, all of these buildings were there in the first temple. That building in the first temple was called, in Hebrew, the Beit Yair HaLebanon, the House of the Forest of Lebanon.
But, so we can find that in the Bible where it says the House of the Forest of Lebanon is referring to a building in the southwest of the Temple Mount.
Right. And it's also going to be found in the book of Nehemiah, where it's called the Beit Otzrod, or the House of the Treasury. And so,
by the way, that was also the headquarters for the Levitical and the priestly order to keep guard, the 24 priestly the guards. That was one of the headquarters for that.
That's right. And we find that 2 Kings 11, 2 Chronicles chapter 23. We find it numbers of places in the scripture that it gives us little clues about this guard chamber, the police station, basically. There were warehouses in the Beit Otzrod, or the House of the Treasury, all types of warehouses for the tithes that were brought, for the freewill offerings, the terumot that were brought, where they stored the firewood, numbers of different items.
So the problem that we have, Joe, is that many people, because unfortunately temple service and its location and functions is not an area widely covered where we come from in the systems of religion, you can really see the names. They're different names, but they never make the connection to one location. They assumed there are different chambers, which they have many chambers, but one building can be called three or four different things. If you understand the temple service, then you will get, really, that comes out, and we can really identify.
Oh, exactly. That's actually going to be a major factor in understanding how all this worked together, how it functioned, because by giving us the name, for instance, the Beit Aftina's had the laver within it.
Right.
And so the laver is going to, in Hebrew, called the Kior. So another name for the Beit Aftina's is the Beit Kior. Another name for the Beit Aftina's is the Lishkan HaGazit, which is the name of the chamber of the Sanhedrin. So it tells us different functions, and it tells us different clues about what was occurring there, where the offices were. The high priest had his chamber inside the Beit Aftina's. Now, we have another building on the northwest corner. It's a real important building. This is where the priest have their dormitory. Each week they have a rotation of the priests, so they call each of these groups a course or a division, and they will come home for 1 week service from Shabbat to Shabbat. And so they have to sleep in the temple. They can't leave. Which brings up a problem, because in the inner courtyard you can't have any toilets. So how do you handle that? We can talk about that in the second hour.
Yeah, they have a tunnel system that would lead to the Tatty Gate. That, by the way, when you took me to the Temple Mount when I was there with you, we can pinpoint exactly where that was at. We
right.
knew exactly based on the measurements. It's amazing. Remember the first time we went up that we lasted like 15, 20 minutes because they kicked us out. The second time I went up, I was able to pinpoint every location because a lot of the cistern heads, they tap them. They're still there. We can pinpoint every single one of these water sources because the Muslims, by the way, the one for number one, for the cistern number one here,
yes.
That's the one that they have the water fountain.
It's right next to the water fountain, yes.
To the water fountain today. It's crazy, right, how everything is right there.
Right. It's called the Alkos Fountain. And Rico, we believe that in the days of the temple, there actually was something very similar that was used by the Jewish men and women to wash their hands and their feet.
But this is important for us to understand, because many people assume that the Gihon spring is the only source. And when you study this, you know that that's not necessarily true. There were other methods of getting water on the mount. And if you understand the laws of purity, you will know they need a lot of water in order to keep that place, the location, clean. And like you said, washing your hands and feet. You cannot go into the temple unless you, one, did a mikvah and wash your hands and feet.
Hey, do you know where the water for the Alkos fountain comes from?
Go ahead. Talk to me. Tell me.
The pools of Solomon.
Many people don't know.
South of Bethlehem. It comes by conduit. And anciently it came by conduit back in the days of the temple. And this is one of the reasons we believe that there was actually a fountain there at that time for that purpose and function.
Actually, you know that I was making posts on my page, and Hanok was very kind to post a little map on the conduit for Solomon's pools. I'm going to post it right now. If you go right now to Facebook, I'm going to try to post it right now because it's right there. It tells you how they did it. And you know, that's incredible. We may have an opportunity to go there next time. We found somebody who may be able to help us. That would be really cool. The bad thing is in Bethlehem, and I don't like going over there with everything going on. But that had to be a feat of architecture and engineering as we know it.
The Beit HaMikdash, yes, oh yeah. And the conduit system is just unbelievable. It is something to see.
Okay, so now we're talking about Beit HaMikdash, which is this northwest building where the priest would sleep and do other functions.
Right, another 8-story building, and it's 40 cubits high, 8 stories. It's going to be the 100 cubits long, 50 cubits wide. We have 4 major chambers in there. There probably were 100 different chambers in there, but there's 4 major ones. There's the dorm for the priest. There's going to be a chamber that's called the token chamber. And we're told that beneath this chamber, in a subterranean chamber, that they stored the stones of the altar that were desecrated by Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, that altar, if you get to looking at the size of the altar, 32 cubits by 32 cubits, it's unbelievable in its size. It's 12 cubits high. If you've got something that size, I mean, you could park 18-wheeler trucks on top of this altar, several of them. And that's underneath one of the chambers. How big is that chamber?
That's huge.
It'd be huge. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the thing, though, that people, we don't take the time to really study the function and the structure of the temple. So we don't realize that when Yeshua was looking at those buildings, we're talking about massive structures.
Right.
Decorated and very beautiful. By the way, I got to make a correction. I kept thinking that the buildings, Beit Aptinus, Beit Osroth, and Beit HaMikdash were 50 cubits high. I'm stand corrected if it's 40 cubits. I got to
40 cubits. Right.
Yes.
Yeah, they're 40 cubits high, and then we're going to have 2 other major chambers in there. They're going to have the bakery for the Lechem HaPanim, or the bread of the face, the showbread, and then they're also going to have the chamber of the lambs. Now, they keep 6 lambs in there at all times. They have to come in at least 4 days before they're going to be offered in the daily service, and so they inspect them during that time. They care for them, but these 4 chambers are inside that building. It's called the Chamber of the Hearth because there was a fireplace to keep the priest warm at night when they would sleep.
So yeah. all of those functions in every single one of these buildings, and we're not really covering anything yet because we know there's a lot more to cover. And so, Joe, before we go on another break into the second hour, I can't believe it's gone so fast. Give them your website. You do a lot of research on the temple. You have courses on your website as well as my website. So my website is wisdomandtorah.com, and you can subscribe to that, and you have one too. And will you please give us the information so anybody who's interested in knowing more about the temple, the level that you teach it, they can go and learn from you.
It's JerusalemTempleStudy.com, all one word, JerusalemTempleStudy, singular, .com. And we have numbers of DVDs or video teachings, audio teachings, and then we have a course on the temple.
Well, this is important that we learn, because right now, I did a teaching on encroachment a year ago, and it created a little bit of ruffling of the feathers, because we come into the Hebraic understanding of Scripture and we want to change everything. And now the priesthood has changed, calendars change, the name change, everything changes. Even the Jewish people are not Jewish people anymore. Everything changes, and now they've gone to the temple location, which I think is a big mistake. Because when you start dealing with the holy things of the Lord, especially of the temple, that's high-level encroachment. That is called ma'al. People need to learn that there are certain things you just don't touch. You know, and I know, that Nehemiah, in the book of Nehemiah, he rebuilt. He rebuilt. The text tells you they were rebuilding the area that was destroyed. They never did anything new. They rebuilt it or they beautified it. So before the break, Joe, we have very limited time before we take a break again, but let's cover really quickly the northern wall, this western wall, and the southern wall that we see today. Those were not there during the time of Solomon and during the time of the Hasmonean. They expanded, and the Western Wall today is actually a retaining wall that was not part of the original structure of the 500 by 500 cubits of the temple.
That's right. That's right. The only wall that we have that's original is the Eastern Wall, but the Southern, the Northern, and the Western were all built by Herod.
So that when Yeshua is speaking about these verses of the buildings being destroyed, he is not in reference to the southern wall, the western wall, or the northern wall. He is talking about the buildings that we have been describing in the sizes and everything we were trying to tell you. So overall, we have so far, we have, including the Sanhedrin in the eastern gate, the small Katan Sanhedrin, small Sanhedrin, and the building for the ashes of the red heifer. That's a small building. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There are 6 buildings itself in the court of the women, including those two. Then you have the main 4 buildings, which are huge in size, plus every chamber and every building. That's not including the temple itself, which is, oh my, what, 22 stories high? You show me a building in Puerto Rico and in Israel, and I was blown away how tall that was. Plus the elevation from one court to the next one. So now
we
have
the Parbar behind the temple building.
Oh,
another major building. Yep.
So far we have at least 10 buildings that no one ever talks about, and we're getting ready for the break right now. So I highly encourage every single one of you to verify what we say. Do not believe anything. You want the resources? Go to my Facebook. I've posted it there. Everything is wide open for you to research it. It's going to take your time and effort, and that's how we get to the truth. Ladies and gentlemen, the city of David, it is impossibility to put a structure that big in the city of David. It's not wide enough, and it's not big enough. It's only 12, 13 acres versus 35 acres on the Temple Mount. And the Fort Antonia, Joe, was there from the beginning anyway. It was not called the Fort Antonia. It was actually built by Solomon, correct?
Right. It's called the Berah. The later on, the Greek period, is called the Baras, the Antonia.
So it is on the Temple Mount, but it is not part of the measurements that makes the Temple Mount, that the temple holy. It's not part of the 500 by 500 cubits that makes the area of the temple. It is part of the Temple Mount, but it's not part of the holiness of the temple proper, correct?
Correct.
See, I pray that some of you will consider looking more into this information, verify. There's plenty of researchers, and this is all verifiable information. So we're getting ready to go on the break right now. We're going to come back for the second hour of our study on the temple location. Joe, I am so thankful that you're here with me. We've been spending a lot of time and hours on this, and we'll be right back for more information on temple locations.
And welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001. Hebrew Nation, His Kingdom, His People, and your radio station.
All right, guys, welcome back to the second hour of the Temple Location. My name is Rico Cortez, and I'm here with my friend and my teacher, Joseph Good. Let me tell you, Joe, you've truly been a blessing in my life. We've been studying now together for 5 years, and I have to say that the last 5 years have really taken my understanding of the Temple to a different level. Understanding, I am more in awe of the Creator for the beauty of His house. And it is truly a pleasure and an honor to keep going deeper and deeper into the Temple. Now, so far, Joe, we have covered the court of the women and the four chambers that were there. We covered the elevation from one court to the next one. We've covered, at least mentioned the sizes and the height of the side buildings and the parvah building on the western part of the Temple. That's not including the Temple itself, which was like 22 stories high. And 22 stories long, equally as long. And now that we've covered the buildings that the Bible, the scripture was telling us that Yeshua spoke, which, by the way, came true, Joe, because every single one of them was destroyed. There's not a remnant of any one of those temple or the buildings still erected, even though we do see the platform, but we don't see the buildings themselves.
Nothing above ground.
Nothing above ground. So what Yeshua did say in reference to the verses we read earlier, that the temple was destroyed and the buildings were destroyed, that did happen 100%.
Yes. Hey, Rico, there's a little interesting side note here.
Go ahead.
We have records of different people that traveled to the Temple Mount from Europe, from Muslim, different periods after the destruction of the temple that did record the ruins that were still visible for a period of time. Uh-huh. The last ruins that were above ground disappeared in 1870.
Wow.
There was a stairway that disappeared in 1870, and that was the last visible remains that were above ground. And that stairway, by the way, was gigantic. It's called the Monumental Stairway.
Yeah, and I saw the wall that covered it, too. It's really interesting because you show me a picture. I have the picture of my house, too, of the Temple Mount back in the 1800s. And we still saw the monumental steps.
Yes.
So the buildings themselves were all destroyed. Now we're going to go into the area that is poorly researched by everyone, including myself, until I met you, Joe. One of the things that when I met you, you were really heavily into the cisterns and the water conduits and the water supply on the Temple Mount. And at the time, I could not understand why you were so focused on that. And I got to tell you publicly that I was wrong, and I apologize because I didn't realize at the time the relevancy and the importance. Now, with all of the controversies going around about the temple location, that's really the smoking gun, because when you study the temple, we come to realization that the amount of water needed was necessary in order to facilitate for over 200,000 people that will go into the temple at any of the feasts. By the way, tell us a little bit about the Josephus quote in regards to the amount of lambs they killed 1 year at one of the feasts of Passover.
I'm trying to remember the details on it. You might have those details yourself.
Actually, I do have it. Let me try to find it real quickly here. And it was incredible when you pointed out to me on Josephus, and I read it. I actually put it on Facebook, and it's interesting that, you know, when we argue about all this stuff, people argue, but then again, when we put the information, no one comments on it. It's like, okay, let's dialogue. If you're going to come up with a proposition about something, well, then we just dialogue and see the whole information in context and allow the Spirit of the living God to bear witness, because then we're committing more transgressions by changing things when the evidence clearly tells us the truth. And that's not honest scholarship. We have to be honest with the information. We just can't make up stuff, anything that comes up, because it sounds logical. And that's the only issue I'm having. It's just things like that. I pray that we will consider researching things a little bit more. All right, I'm looking for the information. There we go. I think I got it.
Okay.
It says in Jewish Wars, Book 1 and 7, paragraph 423 and 424, says, if by any means possible to take the census of the population, and they couldn't count the people, so they have to count the lambs, because per lamb was like 10 people, right?
Right.
Accordingly, on the occasion of the feast called Passover, at which they sacrificed from the 9th to the 11th hour, a little fraternity, as it were, gather around each sacrifice. They mean 10 people, all right? Not fewer than 10 persons. Feasting alone was not permitted during Passover. While the companies often included as many as 20, the victims were counted and amounted to, the victims being the lambs slaughtered for the Passover that year, listen to this number, 255,600 lambs were slaughtered. Now, allowing an average of 10 dinners of each per a victim, all right, 10 people, we obtain a total of 2,700,000 people that visited Passover that year. That is insane, the amount of people. And by the way, the location can hold, you know, a lot of people throughout the feast. They come in and out. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, yes. However, if you're down at the City of David, there's not room.
Why is that? It's only like what? How many acres? 13 acres long?
14 acres. And its width, that's going to be its length-wise, it's about half a kilometer, a little bit less than half a mile. Uh-huh. And the length-wise, it's only going to be a few hundred yards total-wise.
Right.
I mean, width-wise.
So the width of the City of David, if you put the temple structure in its right size, and let's say on the Gihon Spring, because that's the water source, right?
Right.
That means that Beit Aptinas, which is where the key ore was, the labor was, Beit Aptinas have to be almost in the cliff of the Kidron Valley.
Yes.
So the court of the women could not be on the. So let me ask you a question. So everybody that is talking about the temple being in the Ophel on the southern part of the wall is actually the Acra, which is the building built by Antiochus IV during the time of the Maccabeans, correct?
Right. And they just located the foundations of the Acra fortress in the last few years. They had actually been located years earlier by an archaeologist, Igal Shiloh. However, he wasn't sure what it was. He knew the time period. He knew it was the Hasmonean period, but he wasn't sure what it was. When they excavated what's called the Gavati parking lot, they found the other side of this massive fortress that had been built by Antiochus Epiphanes. Guess what they found there? Coins with the seal of Antiochus upon them. There were all types of arrowheads. There have been the battles that we have described in the Book of Maccabees, as well as in Josephus. They located the Acra Foundation. And so we know where that's located. We know where things are found. And it lines up with all the historical texts that we have.
Then how come we don't really study this stuff out? How come we keep trying to do different things? Because of lack of trying to consider all of the information available. Let's go back to the Temple Mount, and we were talking about the mikvah when we were introducing in the first hour about the temple location and the buildings thereof, right? And you talked about number one and number two, which were the mikvahot, one for men and one for women. Now, according to the book, and this is a resource that you must get if you want to understand the cisterns, conduits, and all the subterranean chambers, it's called Below the Temple Mount in Jerusalem by Shimon Gibson and David M. Jacobson. This is put out by DeBar International Series, and this is a book by the Palestine Exploration Fund, right?
Yes, out of London.
Now, this was written in the 1900s.
The actual the reports, one. Yes, yeah. were written in the early 1800s, not the early 1800s, in the late 1800s, about 1865 were the first reports by Captain Charles Wilson. 1868, we had Captain Charles Ward. Then we had Comrade Schenck and Claude Cunder, who were the four main explorers, a lot of photographers, a lot of artists that went over, and they charted the topography of the mouth. They charted the locations of the conduits, the cisterns, the underground tunnels, all the underground structures.
I'm looking at one of the pages right now, figure 11 of the book. It's actually the number. To you, this is not going to make any sense if you're listening because you don't have it in front of you, but Joe is talking about how Warren and Conrad Schicht and all those guys, they sketched it, they measured it, they defined it, they described it. Look how detailed. The cistern... go ahead.
They were royal engineers of the British military.
That's crazy. So watch this. So let's talk about one of the cisterns. We're going to be talking about cistern number one, okay? Which is located on the southwest part of the Temple Mount, directly south of the temple. Okay, now watch this. This is sister number one, and under Warren, Charles Warren is number 36. If you follow the numbering, don't worry about the numbering; it's not relevant to you right now. But we're going to try to talk a little bit more about this. But I want to read you just how these people describe this, how methodical and how incredible information. Now, this is the water source for the mikvaot in the southern part of the temple before they went through the soreg into the court of the women. Listen to this: number of chambers, a main chamber with a single wing. These are the features. Shape as a T-shape with a main chamber constituting the crosshead. Orientation, the main chamber parallel the southern wall of the Haram, which means that one of the buildings there were the Muslims, southern extension parallel to the western wall of the Haram. That means that if you read this and you go to the Temple Mount, you know exactly where it is.
The Haram is the Muslim platform that the Dome of the Rock sits on.
Oh, here you go. So it tells you exactly what it is. Now, listen. The rock level at the cistern, listen to this, 734.7 meters, 1.7 meters below the Haran surface. The wall type, rock face, inwardly sloping. Now, Warren, in 1866, came up with that. Ceiling type, partly of rock, partly of large flat stones. Roof supports with a cistern, none. Opening, a single round shaft entered on the north side of the cistern. So area dimensions. This is the area dimensions of this cistern. Main chamber, 15 times 5 meters. The southern wing of this particular cistern is 6 times 5 meters. The height of the main chamber, 9 meters. This is a huge cistern for water. Now, that's only one. We have, how many we have total, Joe?
Oh,
we have
43, 44, 46. Let's see, we're up to 49. I see 49 cisterns.
49 cisterns on the Temple Mount. And we are focusing to move the temple to the city of David because of the Gihon Springs. When we have the Solomon pools bringing water from Bethlehem all the way through the southern part of the temple. I'm sorry, the western side of the temple. And let me read you the other one. The other cistern, okay, which is number two. I'm not going to read the whole thing, the dimensions and stuff, but I'm going to read you how big it was. Again, main chamber. 10 by 10, 10 meters by 5 meters. This is incredible, the amount of water that this thing can hold, Joe. And people are probably thinking, well, Rico, why is this relevant to us? Because if the argument to move the temple is based on the water source, then clearly we have to cover the water sources to establish the temple. You can't do it without water, correct?
Not at all. Del Rico, you're mentioning the size of these cisterns, but when you look at the number of cisterns and the drawings of the cisterns that were on the Temple Mount, these two, number one and number two, are going to be two of the smaller cisterns on the Temple Mount. I mean,
I was just going to read the next number three.
Okay, well, let's do that.
Let's do that one. Let me read you number three. Number three is going to tell you the location. This is amazing. By the way, according to the researchers, all right, this system is located to the south of the inner platform and is the largest of the underground cavities on the Haram. It was first investigated and mapped by Barclay in 1858 and mapped opposite page 233. A sketch of the interior. Oh, my God, Joe, I saw the interiors. It was sketched out. That thing was huge. All right. Having removed a half-buried marble capital covering the entrance. So this was a way to get down there. They could get down there. It has steps on it. All right. So it says, the bottom of the water at the bottom of the cistern was knee deep, according to Barclay. Together with his sons, measured the cisterns and found it to be 736 feet, 224 meters in circuit, and 42 feet in depth, with a capacity, listen to this, with a capacity a little short of 2 million of gallons of water. That's huge. That's how big one of the cisterns was in the temple. And we have all of this information readily available for us, Joe. This is huge. This is one of the big ones there.
You know, Rico, Professor Roddy Reich. Mm-hmm. Now, first off, let me tell you who Roddy Reich is. Roddy Reich is the archaeologist that has uncovered the Shiloh Pool. He has excavated the southwestern court of the Temple Mount. He has done measurements of the Huldah Gate passageways. He's one of Israel's most famous archaeologists. Okay, mm-hmm. He's from Haifa University. And he is the leading authority on Second Temple period mikvaot, or immersion chambers.
Mm-hmm.
He identified Sister 1 and Sister 2 as being mikvaot.
Okay.
Okay? That becomes important. Now, next to it, we have a grid of conduits. Now, this grid of conduits is for the purpose, you can, inside this catalog, it has a whole section that deals with the conduits, and each of these are numbered, and I want to read what it says for number 12, mm-hmm. which is the number that's there. Get there in just a second. Okay.
That's in the western part of the temple, right? Number 12?
That is in the southern.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I see it.
It's right next to the two big ba'ot. And then, by the way, these are all parallel with the harab. Okay, so it says the rectangular grid rock cut conduit situated between the Aqsa Mosque, that means the Al-Aqsa, and the inner platform is grouped under the single designation. Its unusual plans suggest that originally it may have been located beneath an overlying structure or installation with specific water supply or drainage requirements. It would appear that water was fed into the northeast corner of the grid from the north. A channel extends westward towards the mouth of Cistern 2. That's going to be your mikvah. Mm-hmm. Another channel ran towards the southern shaft entrance of Cistern 4. Okay, so in other words, it's fed by conduits.
Right.
There's water coming from south of Bethlehem in the pools of Solomon, comes across, puts water into both of the mikvahot, and as well as this building. Now, this building we have recognized it as a toilet or a set of toilets, both men and women's toilets. And remember that it said that there was a building above it. That building's gone. Just as Yeshua said, everything above ground is going to be cast down. But everything below ground, it remains.
Right. And this is the proof that shows us and allows us to see exactly where the location of the temple will be. Now, we only have a few more minutes before we got to go on the break again. But I've been leaving this for the last because I think we're going to focus on this particular cistern that is of utmost importance. You actually have to do two chapters on this particular building, which is called the Beit Aptinas. Now, the Beit Aptinas is a building on the southeastern part of the temple on the platform, what they call the Haram right now. But that's where Lishkat HaGassid was, with the Sanhedrin Council, with the Kior, the labor. And we go talk about that, Joe, because we see all the maps and we see all the temple models, and it places the labor between the door of the temple somewhere there in the steps, and the southern part of the steps, and the altar. And we know that according to the Torah now, according to the Torah, the priest could not go between the door of the temple and the altar without their hands washed and feet washed. So now, based on this particular cistern, we can, without a shadow of a doubt, really show you how the Mishnah talks about a passage in the morning tamid, in the morning service. The priest would get elected, to the 13 priests would get elected in order to do the service, and in order for them to walk in the area that of the worship of the service near the altar, they have to wash their hands and feet. Well, if the Torah says that you cannot walk in that area without your hands being washed and feet being washed, then how can you walk there to wash them? You know? So the question is, where was the labor located? Now the Mishnah does tell us. But unfortunately, all the models were incorrect. And now with the cisterns underneath, we can really pinpoint exactly where the Kior was, which lines up perfectly with what the Mishnah tells us in the witness, or what the priest would disappear to wash their hands and their feet. And they hear the sound of the wheel. And we're going to talk about that in the next half hour. The time is going really fast, but we're going to talk about that. So before the break, Joe, I'm really excited to cover this. What do you think, huh? We're going to a whole half hour just to cover this particular cistern.
Oh, it's going to be absolutely fascinating if people could really get into it and understand that what we're saying, if you want to know exactly where the temple is, this is your key.
It really made a huge difference for me, because I remember when you were teaching us about the structure of the temple itself and the walls, and you began to describe from the northern part of the temple itself. I mean, talking about the temple structure, where the holy place and the Holy of Holies was, and you began to describe to us in the Mishnah the spaces between the northern wall, between the walls, and so on and so forth, and then it got to a place in the southern part of the temple where it has a water drainage. And that really piqued my interest. And it's interesting, when we show that to some of the authorities of the temple in Israel, they were kind of really happy and surprised to see how much the evidence supports the location of the temple. And I'm excited to have the opportunity to share this with you. And to some of you, going to be thinking, like, why in the world do we need to know these dimensions and all this stuff? Well, basically what you just said, Joe, everything was destroyed above ground, but underneath we still have the witness of the former beauty of that temple above. And that's what we're trying to search here today on our study on the temple location with Joseph Good. Amen? So continue. Give us one quick fact before we go on our break, Joe.
Okay. We can now, using this particular system we're going to be talking about the next hour, we can precisely locate to the inch where the temple was located, where each door of the temple, each little chamber, everything can be laid out based upon what we find in this system right here.
Man, I'm excited about it. I remember when I was looking at this with you in Jerusalem, and when I was able to be on the Temple Mount, I see it, man. I see it. The beauty of the house of my king, and how it will be restored to its former glory. And this time will be better, because our master Yeshua will be walking in the midst of the congregation of his people. And we need to stand for the temple, for the location. And we have to stop reinventing the wheel, ladies and gentlemen. As you see, it's not just coming up with one verse here and there. It's looking, searching, digging, and verifying information for the honor of the Lord. Come back for the second part in the last half hour of our study of the temple location.
Thank you.
listening to Hebrew Nation Radio, a division of Torah to the nations.
Welcome back to the last half hour of the two-hour study on the temple location. I'm here with Joseph Good, trying to share with you some of the wisdom and the knowledge and the understanding that the Father has given him in his 40 years of research on the temple service. Listen, I know that some of you may be thinking, why do we need to learn all this stuff? Why do we need to focus on the letty-petty little numbers and all this stuff? Because Yeshua told us that every building will be destroyed of the temple. But yet, unfortunately, we never really bothered to look into which temple buildings, how many buildings, how big were they, where were they located, and we disregarded the number one thing that you cannot live without in the Middle East, water.
Water.
And now that you come into the understanding of the Torah, because of the lack of research and the lack of awareness of all the amount of information. Oh, my God. When you go to the Conrad Chic model that Joe took me, he told us the day before, make sure you dress comfortable because you're going to get dirty. You're going to get under the model. And under the model, this man, Joe, this guy was amazing. He was a royal engineer. Is that who he was? Conrad Chic?
Conrad Chic was the only one that was not a royal engineer. He was a resident of Jerusalem. Actually, he worked with a Christian mission over there. Uh-huh. He was an architect and a clockmaker.
Wow.
And so he had skills that he brought to the table. And taking those skills, being a clockmaker as well as an architect, he built models of the Temple Mount, showing the way it was at that time. In the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, Dome of the Rock on top, Al-Aqsa Mosque, all the well heads and so forth on top, but underneath, he showed the underground where the tunnels were, the sisters. Built another model of the temple, actually very, very accurate model, and he shows again, precisely what's on top and what's underneath. So you're able to crawl under the model and you can see these cisterns, how they line up, how they line up with the buildings above.
It's incredible because at that time, they didn't have all the finished research that we have in our hands today.
Exactly.
I mean, this guy is really putting everything based on the limited amount of resources and equipment that he had, and it's accurate. Now, so we have like 25 minutes, Joe, and I know it's not going to be enough time, but we're going to be focusing on one cistern that, according to even some Muslims archaeologists, they bear witness that there was a well of water down there, by the way, and is number 28.
Yes.
And this is the smoking gun here. I mean, this is the one that shows us the water supply. And it's interesting, Joe, because the Mishnah describes a wheel in the Beit Aftinas, in which it would draw water from underneath.
That's right.
Well, that's not from the Gihon.
No. No, in fact, we're told that there is a cistern below it that is what's called a fixed cistern.
Ah, wait a minute. Don't go too fast. Let me read all the dimensions, and then we go right into that. Because okay. The book that I'm quoting here actually talks about this. So check this out. This is the dimensions of this particular cistern, which is found on the platform, on the Haram, where it used to be the Beit Aftinas, where the priests used to do their service. All right? It says, number 28, and according to Warren, Captain Warren, is number 5 in his topographical map. It says it's shaped. It's a rectilinear complex comprising of a straight gallery running north, west, to southeast on three branches. Orientation, northwest to southeast. The rock level at cistern, listen to this. The rock level at cistern is 739.1 meter at Northwest Shaft Entrance and 734.0 meters at Southeast Shaft Entrance. The wall type, partly rock cut, but much of the surface area of the cistern is obscured by a thick layer of plaster. Wait a minute. That means that was built.
Yes.
That was built during the time of Solomon. Correct?
Possibly. I'm not sure when it was built. Yeah.
But it was built because it has plaster on it. There's no roof. The opening, listen to this, openings, four shaft entrances, two circular and two square, and an L-shaped staircase, 1.8 meter wide, with doorways at either end, so people could go down there.
Right.
The linkages, surface conduits on the inner platform of the Dome of the Rock. Listen to this. This is the key. Surface conduits of the inner platform of the Dome of the Rock converge towards the shaft opening of the cistern. Interesting. Because you found this and some of the archaeologists and engineers found this. Let me read this from page 138 of this book. It says, it has recently been suggested by Patridge in 1986 that cistern 28 may have been used to collect water from the space on the southern side of the Herodian temple known as the, say it, Joe, Bet HaHorath Hamayim, literally place for bringing down, draining the water. Let me finish this paragraph and then I'll let you go off with this one. It says, or simply the water drain. The Mishnah Midot, chapters 4, verse 7. And by the way, Midot was written by, go ahead, Joe.
Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov.
Which was a priest who actually served in the temple.
Right.
So this is a primary source.
Yes.
This is not some rabbi in the Middle Ages making this stuff up.
Right. He was an eyewitness to the temple itself.
Okay. Continue. It says, this identification is most improbable. This is what they're trying to tell you. This is the scholars arguing with themselves. Okay. It says, because the Beit HaHorath HaMayim is referred to in the context of the scripture of dimensions of the temple sanctuary. That's the key, really. All right. So that's really the key. Now, Rittmeyer has identified the cistern with the Golah cistern mentioned in the Mishnah, Midot 5:4. So, okay, Joe, this is the key, one of the key cisterns that connects the Beit Aptinas, where inside the Beit Aptinas was the Lishkat HaGazit, the Sanhedrin, was the Beit, the Lishkat HaEtz, was the building for the priests, was also, I'm missing something, what else? Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Where the incense was made.
Yes.
And so now we have all these chambers inside this building, plus where the laver is found. Okay, Joe,
right.
You actually are one of the people in the world, and I did not know this until I went with you to Jerusalem, who actually connected all these pieces together. So go ahead and tell us about this particular system. Remember, the audience, a lot of them don't understand because they haven't really seen it or can identify on the map, so be mindful of the terms.
Okay, Rico, are you placing a picture up on Facebook of what the cistern looks like?
I could. I could do it right now.
This cistern looks totally different from any other cistern that is up there. I mean, in fact, it has this low hallway, if I can call it that. When I say a hallway, picture something that is really massive in size, maybe 20 yards across it. But it goes from the east towards the west. Then it has at the end where it's going to look like a sickle on the top of it, on the western end of it. It has down at the bottom, it looks like the when you have a sword, you have a handle, and there's a little shaft that goes across it. I'm not sure what that calls, the haft, or I'm not sure what it is. And then it's got
I just posted it on Facebook just right now, so you'll be able to see what it looks like. Go ahead.
Yeah. This has been identified by several scholars. I want to mention one, Ronit Amiel, who was at one time the leading expert on the water systems of ancient Jerusalem. And you actually have an article that she wrote, and you saw it published at the City of David one of their publications there. Okay. It's been identified as being a cistern today, but in the days of the temple, it was not. It was actually a tunnel system. Now, we believe that this tunnel system is going to be linked to one of the chambers above in the base. That chamber is called by two names. It depends on how you vocalize the vowels. It's called the Lishkat HaGolah, which would be the chamber of the diaspora, or it's called the Lishkat HaGula, which means the chamber of the roll. We are leaning towards the chamber of the roll because we're told that in that chamber there was a big wheel. Now, a wheel in Hebrew is galgal. That's the Hebrew word for wheel. And that's where the Galilee, which means a circuit, gets its name. Gilgal received its name because their sins were rolled away when they circumcised their children. Okay, now, this wheel, which is in the Lishkat HaGolah, we're told it operated the water system, and you could hear the wheel from a great distance. So we believe that in that chamber, they basically had a pumping system. Now, below in the tunnel. The tunnel today is called by the Muslims the Well of the Pomegranate because there's a rock-shaped structure on the eastern side of it that looks like a pomegranate in its shape. And so basically we believe that that was part of probably a wooden pumping system that no longer is there. Only the rock foundation of it is left. But they would pump water from a cistern below the tunnel, and that cistern is, in Hebrew, it's called, well, actually in English, it's called a fixed cistern. So what does a fixed cistern mean? It means a cistern that's fed by spring water.
And that's way deep underneath the Temple Mount because it says, when you go to the dimensions, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to give people more detail. Let's see how big this thing was. This thing was 54.5 by 4.6 meters on the south. Then you have Eastern Gallery was 28.6 by 4 meters. The northern arm towards the east was 9 meters. They couldn't figure out the rest, the width. And the southern arm on the west side is 17 meters. This thing was huge. The height is not known, and the depth of floor below the inner platform of the rock was 14.63 meters, 15 meters. That's really big, Joe.
It is. It's gigantic. My personal opinion is that there was a whole crew of Levites working probably in this underground tunnel. And that, you know, every day they come and go to the eastern side and go down that stairway, and that there is a whole cistern there that they pump the water from. Now, the water, we're told, out of the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the Tractate Yoma, we're told that it did not come from the Gihon spring, but it came from another spring called the Ein Etam.
Now, wait, you need to repeat that again. Repeat that again slowly, please. It's a very important piece of information.
Yes. Okay. What we're told in that text is that the water that they used on the Temple Mount did not come from the Gihon spring, but rather came from another spring that was below the Temple Mount called the Ein Etam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we believe that this cistern, it's called a fixed cistern because it was fed by the water from the Ein Etam, and it supplied this massive amount of water to the Temple Mount.
That's, you know, and the thing is, when we make a connection, now let's go to the Midot. Let's go to Midot. I know you have your Mishnah there. Let's. How do we make this connection? We only have like 15 minutes, Joe, so we're trying to get it in there, okay? Let's describe in a way that we can all understand the temple now. How do we connect this cistern with the water drainage on the southern side of the temple? So when you go to Midot,
yes,
is describing exactly what?
Okay, in Midot, it means measurements.
Right.
And so it gives us the measurements of different buildings, courtyards, and so forth. And it actually gives us a measurement of the temple building itself. It gives us a measurement that goes from it gives us measurement what in what Mishnah on the height, and then the next Mishnah, which is going to be in chapter 4, Mishnah 7, it gives us the measurements from east to west.
Gotcha.
So it takes us through the measurements of each wall, and just to give you an idea, it says the wall of the porch was 5 cubits. And it was 11 cubits. And I'm going to drop down. The porch was 11 cubits, and the wall of the building was 6 cubits. Then you have 40 cubits, and so forth. All right. Now I'm going to go from north to south. We're told that overall it's 70 cubits total.
The width.
The width. Yes.
Okay.
So we have the outer wall. Is going to be 5 cubits. Then we're going to have a stairway, which is going to be 3 cubits. Then we're going to have the wall on the other side of the stairway is 5 cubits. Then we have a wall that is between the stairway and a little office. There are 38 offices around it. Then the offices are 6 cubits. Then we have 20 cubits for the HaKodesh, the holy place. Then we have the wall on the other side. And then we come to, it says that the wall of the compartment was 5, and the Beit Hardat Habayim was 3 cubits.
Okay, so we're talking about now, for those people who are looking for location, we're looking now at a wall in the southern part of the temple itself.
Right.
Southern
right.
Part. Okay.
Now, Beit Hardat Habayim means it's a water drain.
Oh, gotcha.
3 cubits wide. And it goes from the roof on the western side to the end of the building on the eastern side.
Okay, okay? So it would have to drain somewhere, and not on the temple court, but underneath the structure.
Yes, right. So there was a conduit that was discovered by a man named Perotti. Now this conduit is going to go, and guess where it dumps into? Ah, sister exactly. Number 28. Or the tunnel system, and not only is there the opening there for this conduit and the conduit present, but on the southern side along the wall, there on the wall of the tunnel, there is a trough. So this water that comes off the temple building would go down the drain, go into the conduit, empty into tunnel system number 28, go to the southern wall, come down the trough, and then it's going to take a turn back to the south.
The Kidron Valley.
Yeah, well, yes, but we're still in the tunnel system.
Oh, gotcha.
Then we're going to have a 10 meter. There is a cavity there that's 10 meters. That's over 30 foot.
Right.
That the water off the temple building would drain into. Now, Professor Ehud Netzer made a statement that basically that you should be able to find the conduit that that drained from the temple, the Beit Hardat Habayim, and it should dump into a nearby cistern. So now, Professor Netzer passed away a few years ago. Now that's been found. We know where it is. And this means, Rico, that based upon that measurement, we now configured to the inch where the temple building was located. Not only just the building, but the outer wall, the drain for the water, the next wall, each of the compartments around it, or the offices around it, the wall next to it, the exact location of where the holy place started and it stopped, where the veils were located. We can get to the inch where those were located.
We know because exactly where everything is because the underground bears witness to the upper.
That's right.
Nice. Okay, so Eilat Mazal, she's done major research. We only have like 5 minutes, so we have to hurry up. But Eilat Mazar, which you know personally, by the way. She's done some amazing research in the Southern Wall and also in the City of David.
Yes.
What evidence have they found? I know the answer, but I want my audience to really hear this. What evidence has she pointed out in the 10 years they've been digging there of any temple structure, building, cistern, or anything in that similar fashion?
Good. Down None. In the City of David.
None. Okay, so let me get this straight. So now we are moving a temple that is huge in nature without ever considering the water resources, because the Gihon would not be enough resource. They have to get rainwater, and this is why Solomon, he built the pools of Solomon and bring the conduits to the city, because the amount of water needed was greater.
Right.
So now we are able to pinpoint the proper location, not by speculation or theories, but by actual scholarship and evidence, not only from the Bible, more importantly from Scripture, but also from archaeology, royal engineers, the Mishnah, from primary source like Rabbi Eliezer, Yaakov, and who was there, Josephus talks about this. And this is not, we're not even touching Fort Antonia yet. We don't have the time. But if we understand the dimensions of the temple, there would not be a problem for Fort Antonia to be quite big and still be on the Temple Mount and not encroach on the 500 by 500 area of the temple.
Exactly. And, you know, most of the models actually show the Antonia coming down into the temple compound, but not into the 500 cubits or the sanctified areas.
As a matter of fact, Joe, one of the things that really helped me every day was like life-changing experience for me. It was kind of fun for you to see. I was so excited. I was like a kid. The offset stone, which is the Persian
yes.
stone that Nehemiah talks about.
Yes.
One of the things that really helped me in the Conrad Sheik model, if you're in Jerusalem, come with me in November. I'm taking a tour, and when I'll take you there, and we're going to go through all of that. And, you know, there was the wall on the northern side of the temple, and then from the north, from the offset stone, Herod added the walls to the north and to the west, and within those walls was the Fort Antonia expanded. It never, ever encroached on the temple. So how can you be so concerned with, let's say, 500, 600 soldiers, let's just say 2,000, 3,000 Roman soldiers, and not be concerned with over 200,000 that will go for the feast? That still doesn't make any sense to me.
Dorby, I mean, that right there tells you that the City of David is not a candidate.
Right. There's not enough space to hold a great amount of people that was there, with the topography being the way it was in the first century. Well, thank you, Joe, for being with me. I really appreciate you and all your wisdom and information that you give us, and your humility and your willingness to share. Remember, guys, if you want to know more about the temple, please go to, give us your website, Joe.
JerusalemTempleStudy.com.
Best investment you've made on your spiritual walk, especially with all the things going around. And you can compare verifiable information with resources, and we'll tell you where to find it. We would even share the maps and the articles and anything you need to verify the information so that the Creator can be honored in everything we do. My website is wisdomandtorah.com. And please remember that if you want to go to Israel, check it out. Go with me on November 5th through November 19th. And if you're a Spanish-speaking person, November 19th through December 3rd. Now, another thing I want to announce, on March 21st, I will be back, March 22nd, I will be back on a Wednesday morning, 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time, with a Pastor Warner Mishke, and we're going to be talking about honor and shame and the role of honor and shame in the first century. But Joe, I look forward to doing more programs with you. Thank you, my friend, for being a friend, a mentor, and my teacher, and I consider an honor to sit and learn from you the wonderful things of the house of my king. Thank you, my brother, for being with us. And say goodbye before we have to cut off, my brother.
Well, thank you. And I just really hope that what we said will encourage people to take a look for themselves.
Amen, amen. Shalom to all of you, and thank you to Hebrew Nation Radio for the opportunity to come to you. And do not believe anything I say. Verify everything we say.
Shalom. This word is a light, a lamp for our
The darkness must flee. The darkness must flee from the living word. His light now shines. The darkness must flee. Yeshua.